Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing part two, the second half of my interview with the remarkable, diverse, continually evolving Mike Lang. If you were listening to part one last week, you heard Mike talk about the way he became a musician. You also heard that really ironic story of how he wound up living in the house he's living in for the second time, sort of unbeknownst to himself. That's worth listening to all by itself. But listening to Mike talk about how he became a musician, how hard he had to work, obstacles that he had to overcome to pursue this passion. He says at some point, I had to be a musician because I can't do anything else. Of course, this is absolutely nonsense. When you hear how diligently he pursued discovering, becoming, adding to his skills so that he could continue to do this thing that he has always been passionate about and that he has created such a remarkable backlog of work in every conceivable genre, with every conceivable kind of performer or writer or composer. So in this show, Mike tells the story of how he figured out the career that was to become his. It's so inventive, it's so clever. And of course, lots of people, I suppose, might have figured it out, but lots of people couldn't continue to perform at the level of excellence that Mike continued to and continues to perform. So here's my second half of the interview with Mike. And as I will say in the opening, hang in, because at the end he plays for me in his his living room at his piano an original composition, and it's glorious. So hang in, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh, so I
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being all that you really are so that you can live the best life that is possible for you to live. And if you've been listening to the show, you know that I believe, as a psychotherapist, that most of us are not living the best life that is possible for us to live because most of us don't have access to all that we really are. And how that happens? Well, I believe that for most of us, something occurs in our childhood that discourages us from demonstrating some aspect of ourselves. And as a result, we are living out what I call our cover story. This is the truth about us, but it's not the whole truth about us. Because when we got discouraged from demonstrating something, when we behaved in some way, when we talked about something, when we acted in some way, when we demonstrated an interest in something that didn't go down well with somebody that was important to us in our childhood, then we begin first to be embarrassed about that or afraid to demonstrate that. And so we figure out how to pretend, how to hide, and we get so good at it that we forget that we have that. Well, that is how most of us get through our childhood, and it's a coping mechanism that works generally pretty well. The problem is that later in life, that very thing which you had to hide, deny, and then forget may be something you really need in order to be living the best life that is possible for you. In addition, it takes energy to suppress a part of ourselves, and we could all use a little bit more energy. We could all benefit from not having to suppress energy. Also, when you're hiding something about yourself, pretty much you know it, even if it's a sort of unconscious knowing. It's a discomfort. People talk about it as feeling like a fraud. There's something about me that's not true. And what that generally means is there's something about me that I'm hiding. I know I'm hiding it. I may not know what it is, but I suspect there's something in there, and that thing is not nice. I don't like it. That's why I'm hiding it. So the intention of the Lynn Show is to make this point, to say that if this sounds right to you, if it occurs to you that there is something that you may have had to hide, or something that you really want to be, and maybe you really are already it, but you don't remember it, it's not too late. It's not too late to recover. But it's not as simple as my saying it, you recognizing it, and then, you know, ipso facto, you got it. Because whatever it was that caused you to want to hide it in the first place, when you go looking for it, that obstacle will reassert and make it difficult. So that's what psychotherapy is all about. And if this has struck a chord with you, then you might want to consider looking into psychotherapy. If you want to learn more about that, you can get some information about that on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. Up there on the website, you can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can get me to come and talk to your group of or organization. You can click the Contact Me link and ask me any questions that you have or make comments. I'd be happy to hear from you. And you can listen to or download podcasts of all the shows I've ever done, including this one, and listen to all the interviews that I've ever done, including this one. And this one is part two of my interview with the extraordinary musician, Mike Lang. Where we left off was Mike was about to tell us how he figured out how to get into and got into this career, which was wonderful. I'm starting part two a little bit earlier in part one, where Mike is talking about his discovery of his particular way of looking at the world, his way of staying in the present. I wanted to replay that because it inhabits so much of what he does, and we talk about it later in the show. So without further ado, part two of my interview with Mike Lang, and hang in, because at the end of the show I'm going to play Mike playing live. So here, my interview with Mike Lang.
I don't think that you're the same person through life. You evolve and you start through self-discovery. You figure out who you are and what's possible. You know, I'm still doing it. Yeah, I actually had something happen about 3 years ago. I'd like to call it an epiphany, for lack of a better word. It's just like everything. It was like a toggle switch that was in the off position, and I turned it to the on position. It changed everything. It's just like, if you're the kind of person who meets someone and you tend to look at the things that bug you about that person,
right?
That was extending into certain areas of my life where I identified it. You know, like playing the piano, I would go play an instrument. I immediately figure everything about the instrument that was deficient. It even got to the point once where I was working with Henry Mancini on a movie, and there was a solo piano melody to be played over the strings. And when I played it, I noticed how uneven the notes were, and some would be louder, some would be softer, some would decay faster. So I actually put a dynamic on each note. So if I play this note piano, and this one mezzo forte, and this one forte, it'll all sound
it'll be even. Wow.
And I did it, and when I did it, I sort of thought, yeah, this is one way to do it. But I think at the point when all this changed, I realized, like, this isn't a good way to make music. Mm-hmm. And now what happens with pianos is, it's like with people too. I try and figure out what I like, and I try and make it as intuitive and unintellectual an experience as I can.
Yes.
And so very often somebody will ask me what the piano was like where I played, and I won't have any memory of the instrument, but I'll have memory of what was inside of me and how this invisible thing produced it.
Yes, yes.
And that's kind of the way I like to think of instruments, although, you know, I love really good pianos, and they do make a difference. Mm-hmm. It's nice when they're tuned and all that kind of thing. And if one is really bad, then I have to think about it because it's so
right.
Severe. I have to make
you have
something.
To compensate for it.
I have to do something. But it just became sort of an operative for everything that I do. It's an operative for what kind of choices I make, and in music, those choices can be creative and. So I just try to figure out what's my role here? What can I do? It's like an acting job in a way. It's like, who am I today?
Wow. So it makes you so flexible.
Yeah, but I, as a musician, for me, I live in the present tense. I'm not an improvising musician like an Oscar Peterson who has all of these rehearsed, incredible arrangements and everything is pretty worked out. He's improvising, but he's improvising with massive structure. Massive things of practicing jazz licks, and even though they come out differently all the time, his vocabulary is extraordinarily set.
Yes.
I went through a period of that. He was a really big influence on me when I was younger because I loved the way he swung so hard and was just so visceral, you know. But I'm a different person now. I sit down and it's like I want to play as if I'm playing for the first time or the last time or both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like I once said to somebody, I always think when I go to work for somebody else that it's an opportunity, so it's a beginning, and I also fear that it could be the last time. So this combination gives me a balance of wanting to make it always. I never want to become complacent or like, you know, yeah, I know how to do this, I got this sculled out. I don't want it to be about that. I want it to be about like what can happen.
Yeah.
And often it's not so intellectual. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's very clever and intellectual. But when it's not, when it's intuitive, it's sometimes the best way for it to be.
I'll bet. And I'll bet it feels terrific.
Yeah, but there are times when, you know, I always say that the magic kind of passes through you, and your job is not to interrupt it. Because you don't know where it comes from. It's like you're observing this music pass through you.
Yeah.
And you don't want to impose something, because as soon as you impose something, you destroy that energy, and it takes you to some other place that interferes. There are other days when nothing is happening, so you need to know how to function when nothing is happening.
Because you have the skill. You can do that in any case, right?
Well, the last time I was in the studio, something came up where I had to play after having been in the booth all day kind of supervising. Then I had to go out and do these tracks with just voice and piano. And I really felt disoriented. I really didn't like the experience when I was doing it. I really thought it was bad. Mm. I didn't like it at all. I doubted it.
And then you heard it.
Then we heard it, and I still wasn't sure. And I called the artist the next day, because she's paying for it. It's her project and everything.
Right.
And I said, how were those tracks we did? How was the piano? Because then it's just redo the vocals. I said, how were the tracks? She said, they were great, you know. And I said, I needed to ask, because I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm very sure of what I think my level of performance is. And most of the time, I'm not one to leap up and down right away. You know, it's like the one album that I did, which I'm going to give you, and where I did spend actually a lot of time writing arrangements. This is an album of Henry Mancini's music, and half of it's with a piano trio and half of it's solo piano. And I just thought, and Karen and I talked about it, my wife and I, and it's like, if you're going to record something as well known as Moon River, you nearly need to come to some conclusion about what that song means to you and what you want to, you know, do with it. You don't want to just leave it up to chance. So given that mindset, I spent 3 weeks and wrote very, very intensive arrangements. They still were more about a catalyst for improvisation than a lot of written material, but harmonies were, you know, really worked out and sometimes altered to present something different about the song and the character of the style of each song, things like that. So when I went into the studio, I actually had a safety net that was mm-hmm. different than what I'm usually used to. And it worked out really well, but it took me a long time to realize that the album was any good.
When did you decide that it was good? Do you remember that?
I think it was a gradual process because as time passed, I could listen to it and not feel like I was the person who was doing the playing. I could listen to it just as a piece of music and say, what does this guy sound like?
Yeah.
And then I thought, yeah, it's pretty good.
That must feel good.
Yeah, it does, but I want to keep going, so. I don't want
keep
to
going meaning you want to keep doing more stuff?
Yeah, I want to keep making music, so I don't want to dwell on, you know, I'm not a fan, I'm a musician. I mean, I am a fan, but in my own life as a musician, I need to be going along in the present tense.
So
I don't want to be some elderly guy saying, hey, I did this in 1930, you know, I did this in 1940. No, it's like, what am I going to do today?
Well, it's all the same stuff. It's the being in the moment for you, you know. And
I like the present, and I like the future, and the past is great, but it interrupts time for the other two tenses.
Do you want to say that again?
Sure. For me, it's the present and the future that I want to direct my attention mm-hmm. to, and the past is wonderful, and the past gives us a premise for things that can come after. But the past can also interrupt your ability to spend time in these other two tenses, which I think is, it's more preferable.
I love that, and I've never heard anybody describe it in quite that way, that the past can interrupt the other two tenses. I think that's absolutely right.
And well, I mean, if you're sitting around re-experiencing the past, and that's a wonderful thing for some people to do, for me, I prefer for like what I'm doing with you now and what is it that I'm going to do when we're done.
Right. No, I think that's wonderful. And I just never heard anybody describe it in quite that way.
I've never thought about it and never said it.
No, but well, again, thank you very much.
Well, that's the present tense.
That's
you know?
Exactly right. That's, and that's right. We are here in the present discovering as we speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you discovered that there was a career in being a freelance musician in Los Angeles. And you found a way into that somehow. Do you remember how you did that?
Yeah, I do.
Can you tell?
Yeah, I thought I had solicited, as an initial phone call, I thought I had solicited a pianist who was really busy in the studios because I wanted some connectivity to the process. But actually, I found out later, because this person and I are now really good friends, not that we were ever not friendly or anything, but now it's like an act of friendship after all these years. And she reminded me that I was with my parents at a dinner party at her house. Her name is Pearl Kaufman. And so my father evidently figured out that this is someone I should know based on the fact that she was really busy doing a lot of movie recordings and so forth. But anyway, I do remember having a conversation with her where I said, I don't suppose you teach, do you? And she says, no, I don't teach. And I said something like, good, I want to study with you. That was kind of a manipulative statement, I guess. And I said, you can laugh, but basically I'm trying to make you smile because I don't want to study the piano with you. I said, I've already studied the piano. I never had as a goal to become a concert pianist. But I'm very interested in what it's like to play on a recording session. And I've never played under a conductor.
Oh, wow.
Well, there are very few pianists in symphony orchestras. They're only there for 20th century music. Oh. And if you think about the fact that the University of Michigan had one symphony orchestra, and probably 80% of the time they were playing things that were written before, 1900, so there were no pianos except for piano concertos. And so there was no opportunity.
Right.
So basically, I remember when I first started recording, and I thought the idea was when the conductor is dropping his hand for the downbeat, you're supposed to guess where he's going to end and meet him there. And by doing that, I played ahead of everybody else.
Of course.
Because you're supposed to wait and see, and then you're supposed to feel the room react. And it took a long time, and I finally learned that because the piano is percussive, that the best thing I can do is be late.
I was just going to say, hold back.
Just wait and melt in, unless you're playing with, a xylophone or something like that. So these were all things to learn along the way.
So how did you learn that? I mean, so you talked to Pearl Kaufman,
she took me to one session that I remember. She may have taken me to several, but she was working for Lalo Schifrin. Mm-hmm. And the thing with Pearl is she had such a consummate ability to sight read, and she had such a consummate technique. Composers like to challenge her. So Lalo was a very new composer in Los Angeles, and they were doing, I think, a two-hour movie for television. And there was an action scene. He'd written some chase music, and he wrote this really difficult piano part. It reminded me of Bartok. Bartok has a solo piano piece called the Allegro Barbaro, and it's a very primitive, rhythmical sound. Reminds you of the Rite of Spring or something. Mm-hmm. So very difficult part, and she was just playing the shit out of it, And so I watched all of this. But what actually happened, which was even more telling, was that she introduced him to me, and he asked me what I was interested in doing and all of that. And he invited me to come over to his house. I can't remember the sequence of events, but at one point he was giving me composition lessons as a gift.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a nice person. But more importantly, at that moment, he knew that Paul Horn, who was a jazz woodwind player, was looking for a new pianist. So he recommended me to Paul Horn. And Paul Horn invited me over to his house for an audition, and I passed the audition. Mm-hmm. And right after that, Paul had just moved from Columbia to RCA Records. And he hired Lalo Schifrin to write a piece for his jazz quintet and an ensemble with voices called Jazz Suite on the Mass Texts. So this was a vocal work with a jazz, enlarged jazz band with this concerto grosso kind of jazz quintet in the middle of the ensemble. And that was the first recording session I ever did.
Wow.
And that all happened because of...
Yeah, connecting the dots, right.
When I did the recording with Paul Horn and Lalo Schifrin, he thought I had done a very good job. And he had a series called THE Cat. I think it was a detective series, but I don't even remember. But he had used the bossa nova kind of music to underscore all the dialogue scenes and stuff. So it was a relatively easy job. It was like a small group, with guitar and probably woodwinds and whatever, doing this really pretty music. And, all I have to do is sound like Antonio Carlos Jobim at the piano. And so he gave me an opportunity to do that, and he liked what I did. So he made me the pianist on that show. So I had sort of a recurring studio opportunity. And from that, I can't remember what the next thing was, but I would like to think that somebody knew Lalo Schifrin and heard about me that way and maybe called me. So all of a sudden in the film world, the world of television where they used orchestras in all the series and films, I started getting calls from different contractors who were either calling because they had become aware of me or composers requesting me who had learned about me from somebody else that I'd worked with. So all of a sudden I was meeting people and eventually meeting really prominent composers, people like Elmer Bernstein and Henry Mancini and Jerry Goldsmith and all these, Maurice Jarre, all these really incredible people at the top of their careers and getting to work on really prominent movies and getting asked to do things that occasionally were really exposed and noted, John Barry, long relationship with him. And then on the other side of things, occasionally I would get a chance to do a jazz record with somebody, and I was also getting called to work with recording artists. Mm-hmm. You know, and every once in a while there'd be, like, a big one where the record would be big, like the way we were with Streisand. So being on records like that, then people want you on their records.
That's right.
You know, and what was interesting to me about my work in the record business is I never became like the hot guy to call who was on every top 10 record. And I think as styles changed and musicians had shorter lives in that business, especially if you were in the rhythm section, you know, and you were part of the piano, bass, guitar, drum thing that did all these records, and then all of a sudden the style of music would change and other people, younger people, would come into play,
right,
and displace those people. I was sort of in this sort of, I wasn't as attached to one thing,
yeah. So
I didn't go away.
Right, right, so you didn't lose it.
I was still somebody that was not over-defined.
Right. So. It's all the same thing. I'm sorry, but that's what I see in this pattern in your life, starting really with the white-haired woman, is that you weren't, it's what you said, you weren't defined. You weren't rigid. You weren't definitive. And it's the same thing as you were talking about being in the present, is that you're so open to whatever there is. So that made it possible for you to work in all kinds of different ways, no?
Yes, and some of it wasn't just in the present, like right now. Like at some point, it became apparent to me that I had the opportunity to learn other keyboard instruments. You know, so I was no longer just playing the piano. So first thing that I knew was required in those days, I'm talking about mid to late 60s, where keyboard players, especially in film, would be asked to play organs.
Mm.
You know, like the Hammond B3 organ,
right.
Lowry organs, and they had pipe organs in a couple of the studios. And so I actually spent some time learning how to do some really basic pedaling and how to register an organ. And then out of that, in the record world, were electric pianos, clavinets, and style of playing the B3 that was a pop and jazz and R&B
style.
So all of those became part of what I did, and then after that, synthesizers.
Yes, right.
At one point I was having a cartridge guy bringing this huge quadrangle of keyboards and rack-mounted gear to play on movies.
So it's the same thing. It's that you learned so early to be diverse, and you never lost that.
I'm less diverse now. But it's okay. Well, things change. For instance, composers now are required to do an electronic mock-up of what the orchestra is supposed to sound like. And all the electronic moments in a score are generally done in the environment of a composer's studio with his entourage.
I know.
So it's not like keyboard players are showing up with a lot of synth gear and playing synthesizers during the orchestra. It's not as keyboard, like, let's get a keyboard player to do this. It's more like, let's get somebody who's creative at programming and stuff like that. And so much of the work is done that way. Now, the other thing that was going on with me at that time was, I was working with a group called Nino and April. Nino Temple and April Stevens.
I remember them.
You remember them. Okay.
Mm-hmm,
so they did these sort of white artists doing R&B kind mm-hmm. of records, and they had a shuffle version of Deep Purple, which was a big hit. They were signed to Atlantic Records. Nino was very close to Ahmet Erdogan at the time, mm-hmm. who was a big executive at Atlantic. And so I was playing at a place called the Slate Brothers, which was a restaurant / nightclub on La Cienega. Mm-hmm. And so I was working with Nino in April. I remember we played for Don Rickles, and we played for all these artists who were there. Mm-hmm. So it was an amazing experience to do that. But the thing that happened that put me in another place was that Nino was very good friends with Phil Spector. Phil Spector was actively recording at the time, and Nino recommended me to Phil Spector. Now, because my parents had domestic people who were African-American, I was exposed to R&B music at a really early age. Mm-hmm. They had 78s and 45s, and I listened and loved that music and knew it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anything about this kind of wall of sound, white rock and roll style of music at all. It wouldn't have been anything I would have cared for, to be honest. But I was really lucky because when they called me to play, there were like three keyboard players, and they were pretty much playing all the same thing, you know. So it was basically a rolling, like three-note closed voicing with the octave rolling back and forth, and the left hand would go doom, boom, boom, So that was pretty much it. So I was home free. I could mimic them and be acceptable. So what I love is that I kind of came from the schizophrenic place of stage left and stage right in the recording business right off the bat. I never knew how to do this style of music, but I was lucky that I wasn't the only pianist there and that I figured it out. It's just for good fortune. But I did take it one step further, which was when I had done about 3 or 4 dates for him, and we were in the fade of the song, and all these guys are doing this, and I just thought, what happens if I don't do all that? And I just do a little melodic figure that repeats every 4 bars. So we did that, and I hear this yelling from the booth, who's playing that stuff on top on the piano? And I thought, okay, this is it, I'm done.
Right.
And I said, oh, Phil, I just thought I'd try it. He said, it's great.
Yeah.
So then I, you know, went on with him and found little opportunities. He was becoming more and more unhappy with the record business, and he had a big record with Ike and Tina that was River Deep, Mountain High. Mm-hmm. It was huge in the UK, and it completely torpedoed in the United States. And we were on a date, and he left in the middle of the date, and he never came back. That was the end of his career for many years.
You're kidding.
No, he just kind of retired. And then he came back, and we did some really interesting albums. I got to work with John Lennon mm-hmm. on a record, and I got to work with the Ramones, and I got to work with Leonard Cohen.
Oh, my goodness.
I met Bob Dylan at that session. So there were some really interesting, like, one-off records that he would do before he really stopped making records.
Yeah.
But I mean, from those two experiences, eventually came, slowly but surely, another experience, another experience, another experience. And within, I'd say, a year, I was kind of working, doing recording sessions, more or less, mm-hmm. you know. I was making my primary income from that.
And never looked back?
No.
No. No, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful story. And I am struck over and over again by the, you don't seem to see it as a pattern or a through line, but it seems to me that over and over again you were getting these disparate experiences that really turned you into somebody who could do anything, you know, that could...
Yeah, well, I don't know about the anything, but I do...
Well, you know what I mean. Oh, well,
yeah.
All right, don't... Okay,
no, that's
fine.
Okay. You know, it's like...
Well, have you been
people,
in...
Just to give you an idea of how I differentiate, people call me a legend, and I say, no, I'm a myth.
Yeah, well, this I think is a little bit false modesty here. Just a little bit.
I know how I function. Mm-hmm. I have a pretty good idea of how I do what I do. But because I am this person in the present tense, there are days when I go to work and I feel very fragile, very exposed. And there are a lot of musicians and composers who they have the system and they're locked in and the blinds are right, the blinders yeah. are there, and you hear a guy who wrote a piece in 1955 and then you hear a piece he wrote in 75. There's no evolution, there's no change, they are that person.
Right.
There are a lot of musicians who are like that, and,
yes.
and they're basically the same person throughout their life.
Yes.
And I seem to be, you know, some
evolutionary
to that. Yeah, well, it just always seems up for grabs for me. But I do believe that the most gifted and the most talented people are the people that are most plagued with self-doubt. I think it's part of the syndrome. I'm not saying that because I have self-doubt I'm brilliantly talented, but I just believe in my own life and my own experience because I seem to be open all the time, that it's part of it. It comes with it. These days when you're waiting for that pass-through, whatever that thing is, and there's nothing going on, and then you assemble all your left brain, you know, tricks to get you through it, and then sometimes nothing seems to work, you know. And I confirm this. I'm not going to mention the name of the person I had this conversation with, but he's one of the most important jazz musicians living today.
Mm-hmm.
He's a pianist. And I said, did you ever have a day where nothing was working?
Mm-hmm.
And he told me about one day when he went in to do a record with a really famous singer, and that record never got made, and he felt like he could contribute nothing, and he left. Nothing was really recorded. And he actually said, it's not, and I said, was it the chemistry with you and the singer? He said, no, it was me. That day wasn't meant to happen. You know, I've learned in the past, I guess it's been about 3 or 4 years, I've started to perform at Catalina Bar and Grill. It all happened in a very unusual way. I have a friend who's a singer, and she was going to do a night at Catalina's, and she asked me if I would be her opening act, and then that I would play a couple numbers with her, mm-hmm. and then because she generally plays and sings herself, it would just be a transitional moment, and then she would go and do this. And it was a little, it was odd in one sense, because what I do and what she does musically are somewhat different. So we have these two different audiences, you know. And but the thing that was important about it was it gave me the confidence that I could actually do this. And the club had asked me to do my own night, and I said yes. And it worked out really well. We had a huge audience, and it was very funny. Catalina said, where did these people come from? And I said, Catalina, it's really simple. When you only play once, they will come. I said, when we do this a second time, we'll see if they still come. But, you know, doing it once or twice a year, sometimes 3 times a year, I've been lucky. People do come back, and they're mostly people who know me through my career.
Yeah.
I don't have a street audience, per se. But the thing, that the reason I'm bringing it up is the thing that I found that I have a comfort zone with is talking to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't script anything. It's just whatever I think of saying. And it just seems to be a natural way for me to be. And it also seems something that the audience really likes.
Yeah.
And I think of so many jazz musicians who don't choose to do that, or they minimize what they do. And I know for diehard jazz fans, maybe they would prefer that. Maybe they just want the music. But I think jazz is a mystery to so many people. I don't think it's a disrespect to the music to communicate.
Oh, God. Well, I certainly don't.
So, again, this is all recent information for me. You know, when I played in other jazz bands, I didn't see anybody really, of the guys that I worked with, they weren't doing that particularly. They would say, yeah, this is the tune that we just did, and we're going to do this, and they might say something. But I just thought, it's so easy to play with the audience.
Yes.
You know, and you can say funny things, you know.
Just whatever occurs.
Whatever. I said, how many people in this audience like Madonna? And, you know, people would laugh. And I said, well, we're not doing anything for music tonight, so I guess it's okay. You know, that's probably, I wouldn't do that, but that's an example
of
something more subtle that would probably come out.
So I was thinking when you were talking about self-doubt, that if you're going to continually be on the edge, if you're going to continually be looking for what's next or what you can find inside yourself, or what's new, or where you're going to go next, that self-doubt is very understandable in that context.
Yeah, and you have to make sure it doesn't, you know, stop you.
Well,
I can procrastinate. Doubt can just say, okay, well, you know, I'm a very reluctant composer. You know, if I have a deadline and I have to do it, it gets done. And even though I've never asked to be a composer, in the course of not asking, I've scored a movie. I did a CBS series of 3-6 episodes where they wanted a jazz score, and it was really mm-hmm. kind of fun. I've co-written and written songs that have been recorded. Some have actually sold records. You know, it's kind of like, in spite of myself, things happen.
Yeah, it's a tribute to the talent and to that other thing you were talking about, the fact that you like people, that you're interested in people, that you that you're collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I do. It's
yeah.
fun.
It's perfect.
And it's easier when you're right. You know, I did a lot of compositions with Harvey Mason,
mm-hmm.
who's a jazz artist
yeah.
and a drummer. He's very well known. He's in 4Play. Mm-hmm. Just released a very big solo release for him that he's going to tour with. And at a time, he called me to write with some of the artists he was recording with. So we wrote tunes. I think the first one was for Bob James and Earl Klugh.
Mm.
Then we wrote a tune for Lee Ritenour. Then Lee Ritenour did an album with Dave Grusin. We did something for him. We did something for Tom Scott. I actually got that connection. But what was interesting about working with Harvey is that I would sit at the piano, and he would always say to me, you know, I'm so glad you're here. He says, I can find stuff and write by myself, but when I'm at the piano trying to find chords and trying to find ideas, it takes me a minute, you know. And when you're here, you get like 1,000 ideas a minute. And so the way it worked was because I could create all these ideas, but because there were so many ideas, I couldn't make decisions. Again, it's this decision-making thing. And Harvey said, that's it, that's what we're going to use. So it was kind of
a
nice chemistry.
What a great collaboration.
Yeah, it was a nice chemistry.
Yeah.
And that's the other reason that being a studio musician was so comfortable for me, because I only had 30 seconds to make a choice.
Yes.
Whereas if I'm sitting at home and there's no deadline and I have to actually write pure music, it's, oh my God.
It sounds like you had, in whatever way it occurred, the perfect career for you.
It's a good one.
Well, it's a damn good career. There's no question about that.
No, it's great. I'm very fortunate. There's so many deserving people. Everybody doesn't get the same experience.
No, that's right. That's right. And but I don't. I mean, I suppose there's a certain amount of fortune involved, but I don't. I mean.
Well, the fortune is being at the right place at the right time and being allowed to do what you do.
Yes, but.
So if nobody ever calls you, you never get that chance.
Well, how
so
did
once
you...
you're there, then it's what is the experience, and what is the experience to everybody who's around you, who. When you're new, they're all looking at you.
Yes, they are.
They're looking at you with a microscope. You know, you can be a really successful musician, and you can have a really tough day, and people might not pay as attention. Things might slip by that they never have a problem with and stuff like that. But when you're new, it's like everybody's checking you out, and you know that. And because the experience is new, you don't have this backlog of all these experiences that are giving you, you know, information about how to be. So it's like a first date.
Yes.
You know, you're just meeting this other person. This other person is all these other people, you know.
Yes, that's right.
And so you have to sort of, you just discover yourself.
Do you remember those early experiences when you were new and everyone was watching you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't remember specific sessions. I mean, I just remember I liked being there. I liked being in a position of, I can be heard. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't know that I could be a violinist and live that life, be an orchestral musician. I couldn't be a violinist anyway. I studied the violin. Mm-hmm. It was way hard. Way hard.
So, but are you saying that the violins get lost, but the piano is out there?
Well, if you're a violinist,
you're part
of
a group.
How does anybody know how you really play?
Right, right.
So it becomes it's a very political business. It's a very competitive business. So it's like, how does a violinist get a job? Well, they have to be good, and the people who are hiring you, the concert masters and the contractors, need to know you're good. But how that process takes place, it has to involve, you know, if there are 10 violinists and somebody's going to hire one new person, how do they pick that one new person out of the 10 that are around? It's hard to know why they pick them. Maybe they like that person better. Maybe
the personal
feeling that they get is that it's going to work out. You know, I mean, the truth is there are other pianists, but we all sound audible.
Yes.
We can be discerned.
Yes.
Somebody can say, I like that guy, he plays more this way or that way.
Right. Or I just like what he does, even if they don't define it.
That's true. And very often, when you're playing the piano, there's going to be some communication between you and a composer occasionally. And it's like, how does the composer feel when he's experiencing you? Do you make him feel comfortable?
Yes.
Do you make him feel that you're important to what he's trying to do?
And not only to the composer, but if you're working with the singer.
Yeah.
Are you supporting the singer?
Absolutely.
You know, there are a lot of, in my experience anyway, a lot of piano players can't accompany.
It's true.
They can play, but they can't support.
That's true.
You know?
And I'm fortunately
clearly
very comfortable with playing for singers.
Yeah, clearly.
And dealing with them as personalities.
Yes, yes.
Because truly, when you're dealing with people who are huge stars and are considered difficult to work with, people like Barbara Streisand and Bette Midler and people like this, I never have had those experiences with those people. And what I feel I've learned from watching some of the troublesome things go on, they just really want you to be honest with them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you to bullshit them. They're very under a tremendous amount of pressure. They don't always know what they want until they've heard it.
Yes.
So for an arranger, you know, could do an arrangement for Barbara and she might say, I don't like it, but I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly.
Now then the arranger has to figure out what to ask her in order to know what to do next.
Right.
I don't have to function quite at that level. you know, I mean, Barbara could come and say, I don't like the piano part. And I'll say, well, what?
Right, I'm singing the piano.
I don't have to write and submit it for approval. I can just sit there and submit it for
approval. Right, and say, well, what about this?
And I've been, I guess, lucky. Generally, people just sort of like the decisions that I've made. We don't have those conversations. But when you do have them, you need to kind of figure out what's going to put them at ease. And sometimes it might be a left-turn comment. I remember I was doing a movie called For the Boys. Mm-hmm. It was a World War II movie, and we were doing the songs. And Bette Midler walked by me, and I had played some fills, you know, on the song. And evidently, I had used some kind of pentatonic sort of scale. She looked at me, and she said, what's with the Chinese fills? And I said, well, did you want Vietnamese? And that was the perfect thing at that moment to have said,
mm-hmm.
because of who she is and whoever I am. And
right,
she
right,
laughed and she
right.
says, okay,
we'll
figure it out.
Right.
Yeah, but it could have become this very dark conversation. Well, what do you want? I mean,
what
did I do wrong? I mean, any person who might be intimidated by someone like that,
yes.
it could go left.
Yeah.
But you just have to realize these are really talented people who are very successful. And some of them have egos that, yeah, they get in the way and they cause problems. But I think you can bring out in another person any number of things. And if you make people feel at ease and make people feel they can trust you, it changes everything.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that other thing you just said is that that you can bring out different things in anyone. That people forget that. And also people get reputations, and then their reputation precedes them, and people think that's all they are, and so they behave as though that's all they are.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, there's people who believe the idea of what somebody's like rather
yes.
than actually relating to who they are when they're with them.
Yeah.
And sense of humor is always good.
I think that's right. And also that other thing that you say over and again, the being in the present. Not dragging from the past ideas that you had or the structure that you depended on or whatever it is, but really being in the moment. So many things are more possible if you can really be in the moment.
Yeah, but you are constantly, you have the reference to the past. And
right.
It does provide
well,
you with
you know, it's answers. In your fingers, are you kidding? But
yeah.
Right?
No, but you might just think like, well, this is a little bit like something that I did before.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so another question I ask, which is really what we've been talking about, is that having given a whole life to music, what would you say about what that's like?
What's it like? I've enjoyed doing what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I like being in a studio recording. I like the fact that it's a document, that it's something that's designed to have permanence.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the way our record world is now, that's being challenged as it has never been challenged.
What do you mean?
Well, people aren't buying recorded music.
That's right.
And they're buying it in a very different format, digital downloads and streaming and all of this stuff. There's not much financial royalty for artists anymore.
Right.
So it used to be, in the old days, you'd spend, you know, if you're a big artist, you might spend $500,000 on a recording. And then you would tour to promote the sales of a CD.
Right.
And they would sell a lot. And the tour would be the promotional tool. Now, performers have to make their money performing. That's where money is. And the CD, if in fact it goes with them, it's a promotional tool for the tour. So
wow.
It's all reversed. So the work that I get to do, generally, unless it's a huge, huge artist, people don't have the kind of budgets that they had to do recordings anymore.
Right.
So the only thing that's left that has big budgets are the large movies. And this gets into a whole other conversation about the fact that work has dwindled for Los Angeles recording musicians.
You had it when it was at its best.
I did. Somebody once said to me, our timing was perfect.
It's right.
And I laughed. I said, yeah, who knew? But if you're 25 years old now and you're trying to be a musician and work in Hollywood, it's just...
It isn't there.
It isn't there.
Right. Yeah. Well, so you said at the very beginning that you had to do this because you sucked at everything else, but I think that's clearly not true. I think you had to do it because it is who you are. And it fits you and serves you and feeds you. Would you disagree?
No. No, absolutely. Sounds right.
Okay. Well, this has been wonderful, and I want to ask you to play live. Do you mind?
No.
Oh, let's do that.
I wrote, which is called Mandela. It's a requisition to have the world get it together and have peace. And it has a melody, and you'll hear that. But it basically is a catalyst for whatever else is going to happen. And what happens at the beginning is always different. And then it'll settle into it, and then, I don't know, see.
Okay, we'll see.
Thank you. Stella by Mike Lang.
See?
Thank you very much, Mike. This is amazing.
Oh, great. Well, thank you.
So, as always, it is my hope that you heard something in this show that you can use. Something interesting, something titillating, something that made you laugh. Or maybe it's just, as I sometimes like to say, the pleasure of listening to Mike Lang play. In any case, something I hope that will bring you back. Because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle.